Well, good morning. Morning, everyone. Welcome to CSIS. Nice to see a room full of people for this discussion this morning on Sudan. Always timely to talk about Sudan, but at the end of another sort of tumultuous year, it seems like a particularly good time to have a discussion this morning, and I'm really glad that we've got two such distinguished Sudan experts with us. My role is just to kind of introduce them, really, but I'll just give a quick overview, I suppose, of where we've come this year in this sort of fast-moving political and economic and geopolitical scene in Sudan, where we've seen really the NCP government now in its 24th year or so in office come under more strain perhaps than ever before. First, of course, trying to get used to this new political reality down south with a new and independent and self-confident South Sudan that's been quite assertive in defending itself militarily in some cases, but also politically and diplomatically in trying to push for a fair deal on the terms of its divorce from Sudan. This has had a huge impact, of course, on Sudan's economy, hit hard by the loss of all that territory and the oil, of course, that comes with it, and dealt another blow at the start of the year with the decision by South Sudan to switch off its oil production entirely rather than pay the fees that Khartoum was demanding for use of its pipeline. So this economic crisis has really begun to bite this year. We've had sort of stagflation, I guess, and austerity measures hitting home, hitting the middle classes increasingly as well, bringing people onto the streets to protest, against economic conditions, but also the NCP government and some demands for President Bashir to depart. The NCP responds in its usual way with brute force. So perhaps some of our excited talk earlier in the year about the Arab Spring reaching Sudan was a little bit premature. But there is, I think, a sense that the challenges really are stacking up for this government, and the regime is facing perhaps its biggest crisis to date. Not only is it facing protests on the streets and economic crunch, but the peripheral regions of Sudan remain on fire. The wars in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile quickly have turned into a costly disaster for the NCP. Last year's peace agreement in Darfur has inevitably unraveled. The armed opponents of the regime are coordinating their activities perhaps more than ever before. And then you have the traditional political opposition in Sudan that remains relevant, even if the old divisions are still very much in evidence as well. But perhaps the biggest threat to emerge for the NCP this year comes from within, and we'll hear a lot about that this morning, I hope. The NCP has always been a very broad movement, but it's been fairly adept at keeping the internal divisions in check, but those cracks are starting to appear now in this sort of loose alliance of Islamists and military men and business elites. Anger at the loss of South Sudan, anger at the blatant, flagrant corruption, anger at the failure to promote younger people within the NCP. In particular, deep splits within the Islamist wing of the NCP. Then recent events, a coup or whatever you want to call it, that's been cited by the regime and the arrests of several really quite senior figures previously linked to the NCP. Add to all that, President Bashir's health has also become an issue, with frequent departures out of the country, apparently for surgery. So, should all these developments this year raise hopes of a political transition? And if so, how will this transition likely play out? And what role will or should the NCP or elements within the NCP play in it? Can we avoid violence? And is there a role for outsiders in helping move things in the right direction? These are all really important questions, and they're questions that are addressed by International Crisis Group in their new report, which I hope you picked a copy up of when you came in, Sudan, Major Reform or More War. It's a very timely report, and it's also very timely domestically here as we think about a new term, a new administration here. Good chance to look at current policy and take a fresh look. A lot of key people working on the Sudan brief are moving on in coming weeks. Obviously, the Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of State, and the Special Envoy to Sudan. So it would be good to think and discuss this morning in the Q&A what advice or recommendations we could give to the new leadership team, whoever they might be, who are going to be taking on this really difficult brief early in the new year. So with that, I'm going to introduce my speakers. You pick their biographies up, I hope, on your way in, so I'm not going to give them a big, long introduction. But to my immediate left, E.J. Hogendoorn is Africa Deputy Program Director for International Crisis Group, where he covers this really troubled region of East Africa, the Horn of Africa, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Uganda. Have I missed any of them out? Okay, that's probably enough. And Kenya, of course. How could I miss Kenya out? Which is keeping you very busy at the moment as well. And then to my far right, far left, Omar Ismail, Enough Project Advisor. Sudan expert, one of the people I always turn to when I have questions about Sudan, all-round good guy as well. So looking forward to hearing both of you discuss these issues this morning and hopefully allowing lots of time for your comments and questions as well. So with that, EJ, you're going to start things off by talking us through some of the highlights of your report, and Omar, you'll follow on afterwards. EJ, thanks.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I should say, I mean, the premise for this report was kind of our perception that the international community, for understandable reasons, was focusing on the North-South talks between Khartoum and Juba and the border and the disputes there around. And it was our kind of perception that, well, while that is fine and good, without also addressing governance in the North and in the South, none of those peace deals are going to be durable, because ultimately, if there's going to be unrest either in Sudan or in South Sudan, it's going to pull the neighboring state in. And so we were trying to make this argument that while, admittedly, there's a good reason to focus on the North and South, don't forget what's happening internally in both Khartoum and in Juba. And I should say we're also working on a somewhat similar report that's looking at the situation in South Sudan. Now, to kind of start off this talk, I want to state the obvious to many Sudan observers, which is that the fundamental problem in Sudan has kind of been acknowledged by most observers and certainly by many Sudanese for decades, and that's the so-called marginalization of the peripheries at the expense of the center, and the fact that political power and economic development is concentrated very much in the center at the expense of peoples who live in the east, in Darfur, and in the southern regions of Sudan, and arguably also in the north. And Sudanese elites have been trying to grapple with this since before independence. There have been a number of major attempts, at least in our view, to try to address this question of marginalization and to think about what kind of a state Sudan should have and what would be required to bring the peripheries more into the center and to kind of equalize development and to deal with many of these grievances that are leading to chronic revolt against the center. And, you know, obviously, if you're interested in that, we go through that in quite some detail in the report. But we do think that right now we could be at a tipping point for Sudan. I certainly agree with Richard that the regime is in crisis. I would argue it is probably in its deepest crisis since the 1989 coup led by Omar Bashir. And that crisis is so encompassing that it's very difficult for the elite to find a way out. The challenges it's facing, as Richard alluded to, is the economy is collapsing. Even before South Sudan decided to cut off oil production and thus deny Sudan the pipeline fees, it was looking at a $7.7 billion fiscal gap that it could not cover. It is heavily indebted. It cannot basically borrow money on the international market. It is only receiving small amounts of monies from its remaining allies in the Gulf. Inflation in the country is at about 45% annually. It's probably higher than that, but that's at least is the official figure. And the country, which had been the food basket of the region, has over 20, 25 years become a net importer of food. And now it's come to the point that Sudan is actually importing about $4 billion worth of foodstuffs a year. And this, of course, is matched by the fact that world food prices are rising significantly. And not surprisingly, there's a lot of discontent, particularly in the urban areas where the poor are having a very, very hard time making ends meet. While the economy is collapsing around the regime itself is deeply divided. There are calls for reform from many different parts of society and many different parts of the party, which, like it or not, is a national party, is a party that's trying to represent many different sectors of society. And because it is such a big party, has to somehow manage all these different trends and these different grievances that are cropping up internally. People are particularly unhappy, of course, with the running of the economy, which was actually one of the things that the NCP thought that they would be doing better at than previous regimes. There is this sense, hard to prove, of course, but that corruption is deeply ingrained in the party and in the government. There are deep divisions about how the North should deal with South Sudan and also with how the North should deal with the revolts in Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile and to a lesser degree in Darfur and some of the growing unrest in East Sudan that we're hearing about. And there was an attempt, a major attempt, to try to initiate a reform process during last month's Islamist Movement Conference, which was going to be a major evaluation of where the party was going, whether the party still maintained the ideals that had brought the Islamists to power. And rather than reform, what we saw happen was actually a consolidation of power by Bashir and a clique of people around him, which have angered many, many people who hitherto were allies of the party and at least of the intent or goals of the Islamist movement. And essentially what we see happening is that the people that are in charge are dead set on trying to maintain a status quo. The problem, of course, in our view, is that the status quo is unsustainable and will only lead to a deepening crisis. And really the question is, what will that crisis lead to? Now, in addition to the divisions within the NCP, you do have a growingly assertive opposition movement. I'm sure you're all aware of the periodic demonstrations that have come up in Khartoum and some of the other urban centers. The problem really in our view, though, is that while the opposition is growing somewhat more assertive, is becoming somewhat more popular, they remain deeply divided amongst themselves, amongst the old so-called traditional parties that are all very, very distrustful of each other. And also of these new segments, I guess, if you want to call them, of the revolt, the youth, other activists, arguably even some of the middle class, who are also deeply distrustful of these old parties and the roles that they have played in previous regimes and deals that they have cut with the NCP in the past. And while that revolt is occurring, you also, of course, have the growing insurgency in the peripheries at least for now, are growing somewhat more unified, are becoming somewhat more of a threat. Now you cannot just talk about the SPLM revolting against Khartoum, but you have to talk about the SPLM and its alliance with Darfurian rebel groups within the Sudan Revolutionary Front, the fact that it is actively trying to form links with other restive groups, particularly in East Sudan. And altogether, in our view, these represent a fundamental challenge to the regime. The problem really in our view and what we really grapple with in this report is everyone wants reform, everyone wants change, but I think there hasn't been that much thought about what kind of change do we want and how will that occur. And the reason we raise this is because we do fear that unmanaged regime change by either a coup or by the toppling of the regime, could actually lead to wider conflict in the country. And the reasons are numerous. If there is an attempted coup in Khartoum, there is actually a good chance that that coup would not succeed in a peaceful manner. Bashir, who took power in a coup himself in 1989, knows the threat that a unified military force represents. And thus, what he has done is he's actually divided and fragmented the security services, made them loyal to different people in the regime. And it is not a foregone conclusion that an army led coup would be able to take power and would be able to essentially impose peace and stability on the capital, let alone on the rest of the country. And if you were to have a coup that was resisted in Khartoum, you would obviously have fighting in the capital, but it is our fear that that fighting could then very, very rapidly spread throughout the rest of the country. Because as many of you know, there are lots of different armed tribes in Sudan. Many of them have these popular defense forces or other quasi-official militias that are more loyal to their leaders than necessarily to Khartoum. And you could have a scenario, which I should say the NCP tends to promote, that you could see the collapse of Sudan into kind of a Somalia-type situation where you have different tribes struggling for power in their particular Hakura. Of course, the alternative is that we could have a peaceful, or we could have an attempted coup within the party. The problem there, of course, is somewhat similar in that, in our view, the party is deeply divided. There are different strongmen that Bashir has been able to sit above but has never been able to control completely, who have been competing for power for the last 20 years. I'm sure many of you are familiar with all the stories. And that these tensions could also lead to open warfare. Now, that's not to say that we couldn't be wrong. I mean, obviously, it is possible that something like this could occur. But it is just our warning or our position that that the likelihood of a peaceful coup is much less than many optimistic people would like to think. So then what? Well, then I think we need to start thinking about what we are calling a managed transition. And the question is, how could one incentivize that, and how could one actually achieve some kind of a meaningful move to a more inclusive and representative governance in Sudan? And for us, in this respect, Bashir is the key. He is the key because he is in charge. As I've mentioned, he's been able to kind of keep this very unruly set of elites in line for the last 20 years. And he has every incentive to stay in power unless we give him some motivation to do what we think is the right thing. I mean, Bashir is stuck in a very difficult position. If he gives up power, he could end up in The Hague. And because of that, he has very little incentive to reform meaningfully, certainly very little incentive to give power up in the interest of his country, and very little incentive to work meaningfully with both the opposition in Khartoum and with the Sudan Revolutionary Front and other opposition forces in the peripheries. And so the somewhat interesting recommendation we've made is that the international community needs to start thinking seriously and deeply about what it can put on the table to give Bashir the incentive to reform, to create some kind of a transitional government that can manage a transition. And I should add that transitional government needs to include the NCP. I think we've learned from Iraq that de-bathification, so to speak, is problematic, and the NCP basically has been the government for the last 20 years. But it also needs to include meaningful elements of all the other opposition parties and all the other opposition forces. And those forces are the ones that are going to have to come up with what we have called, for lack of a better term, a roadmap for a transition that will lead to a meaningful national dialogue on a new constitution for the country that will again grapple with many of these issues that have troubled Sudan since independence, i.e., how do we deal with these marginalized areas? What kind of government should we establish that will deal with their concerns? And that once that process has been initiated, then we would argue, incentives should be put on the table for Bashir to let that process move forward and to move out of the way. And with that, I'll put it over to Omar.
Thank you, James. And thank you, CSIS, for hosting us and for discussing the issues of Sudan. As a Sudanese, I feel that this institution had paid a lot of attention to the issues of Sudan through the years, came up with solutions, and we are grateful that you are all here, familiar faces, friends, people that I've known through the years here in this town. I learned from quite a lot. And thank you, Richard, my good friend. I represent enough, but also I have my own kind of like ideas about what is going on here as Sudanese. Sometimes I'm caught in the middle between what is really enough here and the policies and all that, and my sentiment as a Sudanese who is not who is definitely biased in this argument, and being from Darfur as well is not helping a lot in terms of being objective. Having said that, I think we agree with everything that ICG said in terms of the analysis of it. The crisis, as we've known through the years, chronic conflict, in a place where the government is concentrating the power and resources in the center. And we also agree on the solution, that the best solution is a negotiated settlement by which this cabal in Khartoum is going to be dismantled and a new transition to democracy and peaceful Sudan is the desired outcome, and to ensure the power and resources will be equitably distributed between the Sudanese. However, we kind of differ a little bit on how that is going to happen. And these are differences in the way to deliver this. And it's a fundamental difference in my mind, based on two different approaches. I will give examples, but I will have to also agree with ICG on one thing, that while the focus of everybody is on the north-south and how these two countries can manage their relationships or differences, I think it is equally important to look at the dynamics in both countries, and that is why we are talking about what is happening inside Sudan. In the examples that I'm going to give, just for the sake of argument, is going to be different examples. Some of them are just Sudan-specific, and others have something to do with both the north and the south. And I think the issue for us at ENAF, and here also as a Sudanese, I think we can achieve solutions through consequences, not through incentives. We've tried that. We've tried the Grecian approach of gold stars and cookies. Never worked. While we have tried other approach that we advocate, and it worked. And we had the CPA, and we had even the latest agreement in Addis Ababa as a result of Khartoum seeing what we call in Sudan the red eye of the international community. That is what Khartoum understands. That is the language that Khartoum will give anything if you use. And I will go further than that to say that we have put out some recommendations in our own reports, and some of them, the latest one about the mediation between the north and the south that is led by the African Union. And I think that we clearly defined the disincentives related to non-compliance, and we asked the EU to follow this. And we are asking the international community to do this, and I'm giving examples. For example, in Abyei, if the UN Security Council fails to identify consequences for non-compliance, we thought that Abyei final status may remain unresolved indefinitely, ensuring that the area remains a potential catalyst for north-south violence. That is just obvious, and we have seen that. There were resolutions to Abyei, and when we moved away from that to appease Khartoum, the result is what we have seen. We said clearly in the CPA that there will be a referendum that goes with the referendum of the future of the South itself, but everybody moved away from that. What Khartoum gave us, because that was the incentive for Khartoum, to let the South go, if some people believe that is one of the incentives, then where are we in Abyei today? Abyei remains the Kashmir of Sudan, and we are until today believing that if there is a war between the north and the south, I personally believe that the first bullet is going to be fired in Abyei. And the aid, we worked hard, all of us, to bring in the tripartite initiative. One of the few times that we find the UN agreeing with the EU, agreeing with the Arab League, and we brought the Sudanese from both sides, and we said, this is for the humanitarian access, for those people that are receiving more bombs and shells every morning than they are receiving food. What happened to that? Because we thought that Khartoum is going to play the game, we ended up with the tripartite going south, and the imposition of measures against the Sudanese government officials responsible for the continued denial of unfettered access to these areas, I think it is the responsibility of the international community, and for that, Khartoum should not be left unchecked. The border, the UN Security Council, we believe, should stand ready to enact the measures to ensure the enforcement of the AU-imposed final and binding resolution to the disputed and claimed areas should the governments on any side fail to reach agreement on a mechanism to resolve their dispute over the border. Other than that, I think we are going to see a border that is 2,000 kilometers with all kinds of problems. And I think there is an opening there because now the Sudanese, who are mostly supportive of the NCP, as few Sudanese supporting the NCP as they are on this border, on this side. When the border is closed, these people vehemently went to the NCP and they complained because their livelihood depends on the trade between them with their neighbors and the tribes that are divided in the middle. And the opening is there for us. If we push the NCP harder enough, we will have an agreement on the border. All the North-South negotiations, including oil, everybody clapped. And this is the thing with the international community, the short memory. We signed the CPA in Nairobi, and all scrambled to get the first business class seat out of Jomo Kenyatta. And we left the two countries to their own devices. When we revisited the issue 5 years later, we came back and, by the way, what happened on the CPA? That was the question of the international community, asking those guys. And the protagonists are there. And everyone is doing what they do best to undermine the CPA. And one of the best things that we have achieved fell apart because we did not stay the course implementing and actually setting the rules where the consequences should be when any of the parties did not comply. So I think achieving what we want to achieve, that is a peaceful transformation in Sudan, begs us to look at the behavior of this cabal for the last 25 years, or 24 years that they were in power. All the incentives that we threw at them through the years, and they were money, none of that worked. They just do enough to get the international community off their back, and they go back to their same old system. Because, people, we have to understand, this is a different mindset. The mindset of the Muslim fundamentalists, the mindset of the suicide bomber, who is like, this is a zero sum for me. I either have it all or destroy it all. This is the mentality of Khartoum. And this is the mentality that produced Bashir and produced this clique that is there clinging to power all these years. No matter, even though they are divided today, they are divided over that chair. They are not divided over who is going to become the person that is going to take over this so that they can become different than what they have been doing. Because the mentality is the same. The ideology is the same. We assume. Because we see this in other parts of the world, in other places. Because the world had only experienced Islamist fundamentalist government in two places. And these are the two examples of the Shia world in Iran. And we don't want to go there because we all know where are we after all these years. And I don't know who is going to stand there outside and say, oh, let us work with Ahmadinejad. Let us give them incentives. Let us change this. And you see what the world is going to tell you. And the other example is Sudan in the Sunni world. And these are two sides of the same coin. And today, they are working together to undermine whatever the world can give in terms of opening up and trying to have them transform themselves into something else. They will never transform. And I remember both the two gentlemen that are no longer with us. It was, I believe, coined by John Garang, and it was repeatedly echoed by Donald Payne that this regime is too deformed to be reformed. Repeatedly. And we, every time we try and give them something, they don't have that, they don't have the ability to understand this. They don't have the ability to transform. They don't have the ability to see that. In order for them to survive, they have to play the game. But they go with you as far as they are getting what they wanted, and they recoil. And they do the same thing, and then we have to play this game with them again. Somebody might say to me, okay, and where are we using all the other measures, the consequences? It's a legitimate question. And my answer to that is because we have not applied that uniformly. They know how to manipulate the international community. They are like kids playing parents. You cannot go to the movies, and then you come to the mom and you say, Mommy, I want to, you know. And the international community obliges every time. Khartoum, led by Bashir, they know exactly what they want from the international community, and they know how that fit in their strategy. Us, we never figured out what that strategy is, and we are always trying and failing to understand what it is. But it is simple. It is the strategy of survival. I will be here, and I will control this situation until the end, and I will die in this office. It is the same barricade mentality that ended Gaddafi, and it is now going to end Assad. This is the same mentality. When it comes to that, it is the same mentality. I'm going to be here, and I'm going to do whatever I want to do. The Sudanese became weary when the international community says we are going to do business with you. You know why? Because the minute you let up, they interpret that as being weakness on the side of the international community, and they are given carte blanche to do whatever they want to do. Sudan observers, please speak up if that is not true. Every time, they get a reprieve this little, they either send more troops, they kill more, they send more, they buy more weapons. You give them money today. We incentivize them by saying, we are going to forego some of this debt. We are going to give you some money to alleviate the suffering of your people and to give you a chance so that you can handle your economy better. No. The first thing they will do with that money is to go and buy weapons and also to buy more alliances or allegiances if they can. The reason that they cannot do any dent on that is because they run out of money. They tried this with Darfur, and it worked fine because divide and rule. And every time, bring in a little bit of these groups, give them a little money and a few positions that mean nothing. And then at the end of the day, turn around and hit them. That is what Tijani says understood 2 weeks ago when they went out there. And instead of absorbing the little troops that he had inside the Sudanese army, what they did in Darfur, they went and hit them. And they came in Al-Fashir and they celebrated. They brought in the deputy chief of staff from Khartoum to celebrate in Al-Fashir. And they are thinking that they can tell Tijani Seseh to keep quiet. He, unfortunately for them, he didn't keep quiet. The same thing that happened to Mini Minawi after Abuja. It is the same mentality. So looking at this, there is no way that Khartoum will use the incentives to do anything or to change. The corruption is going to continue. Transparency International had a report just the other day. Khartoum where? Bottom 8, bottom 6 of 176 countries? Is that a regime that you want to give them money and to give them incentives of opening up and say, I'm going to give you a little more money to go down the same road? I don't think that is going to work. I urge the international community to go back to the formula that worked and worked every time. And we will have to do it together this time. And we have to support the opposition that is fledgling, it is weak, it is divided. Yes, all oppositions, anywhere, they start the same way. And I will give you an example from within the Sudan itself. This SPLM that is running the South today, regardless of whether it's a viable country or this or that, they achieved one thing. They achieved the independence of the South. And that is in itself is a big prize. There were 32 factions at one point. And there were people who are now today running the affairs of that country who challenged John Garang and who wanted to kill him. And we all remember what happened in Bor, and we all remember what happened in Nasser, and we all remember who is the second man today in the South and what he did with the SPLM. This is not new anywhere. The news today that 114 countries acknowledge the Syrian opposition. If you look back 2 years, there were two countries that acknowledged this opposition. And now even the Russians, even though they try to deny it today, they are also, you know, coming with the rest of the world saying Assad days are numbered. I'm not saying that we have to go and give, patriots or, you know, the stinger or what have you. I'm not good with, I don't know, all these arms and to support the SRF or somebody who is going to invade Khartoum tomorrow. No. But there is genuine opposition in Sudan. Yes, fragmented. Yes, it's not working for now. That is because we always try to do business with Bashir and we condemn them because they cannot do this change. The change is coming. They can do the change. All we have to do is to work patiently with the opposition and try to create that transition in Sudan peacefully. Because we can argue in Washington all we want or in other capitals. What is happening on the ground is happening on the ground. The money change that we want, we have it written on the wall today. And if we don't hurry up and do this, maybe that change is going to happen. And our fears and the worst nightmare is going to happen as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you. So a lot of agreement, it seems, on the problem, but some disagreement on the potential solution. So let's open the floor to questions. But perhaps before we do, I just want to ask EJ first to talk a little bit more about this recommendation in the report for raising the issue of a possible deferral of the ICC indictment to Bashir. That would be linked to a roadmap for change. Could you talk a little bit about how this such a process might actually work on a sort of operational level? What would be some of the marks along the way of this roadmap? How would you enforce it? And then how would you go about selling such a message here in Washington, particularly with a Congress which is probably shares Omar's view of how to proceed in Sudan? Do you want to think about that while I ask for more?
No. This will give me an opportunity to respond a little bit to Omar. And I have to admit, I respect Omar tremendously, and I think that Enough is doing a great job raising attention to the humanitarian consequences in South Sudan, in Blue Nile, and elsewhere. And hopefully we can respectfully disagree. For us, I think the real issue is how are you going to get change. Are you going to get change on any of these issues unless you change the regime? And then I think where we might be at a fundamental impasse is the question of what kind of regime change do you want? I mean, it's our analysis that we don't have time for patient work. We've talked about these multiple crises. The regime is teetering. I mean, the economy could implode. If there is no oil deal, which we think will be very difficult to arrive at, the money's going to dry up. Things are going to get much worse. And I think the consequences are pretty serious. I also agree with Omar that, arguably they have a barricade mentality. But do we really want to have a Libya or a Syria in Sudan? And that really, to be perfectly frank, that's our worst-case scenario. And our question really is, how can you avoid that kind of a consequence? And unfortunately, it's our assessment, and perhaps it's wrong, but I certainly feel it's right, is that the U.S. has very little sticks left. I hate to say it, but after the West decided that they were going to intervene in Libya to protect civilians in Benghazi, issues like a no-fly zone, issues like forceful provision of assistance, humanitarian assistance to very, very needy populations, is a non-starter in the AU, in the African Union. It's a non-starter. And that's not getting to the issue of the divisions within the UN Security Council about what should be done in Sudan and what are the appropriate measures that the Security Council will take. So I think it's going to be very, very challenging to get any kind of consensus from the international community on a way forward. And for us, that means then, well, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to have the status quo. And to be perfectly frank, I mean, when it even comes to concessions on things like Abe and Southern Kordofan and so forth, it is our assessment, again, it's just ours, but that Bashir is against the wall. Because of all these crises that we're talking about, because Bashir lost the South, because of corruption, because of all these things, Bashir has no wiggle room. And to be perfectly frank, that's why we think he was very, very obstructive in the talks in Addis Ababa. And if you really look at the success of the September agreements, much of that was due more to concessions by Kiir than by concessions by Khartoum. And I think, again, it's because of the very, very delicate situation that Bashir feels himself to be in, where he's trying to mediate between these hardliners and reformers and all these other elements within the government, that makes it very, very difficult for him to initiate any kind of meaningful negotiating process with the South. Now, that gets us back to, well, what incentives are we talking about? I fully agree with Omar. The last thing you want to do is say, Bashir, you're going to get $5 billion if you do X, Y, and Z. And, you know, we go... In our report, we tried to kind of balance being too prescriptive and trying to just present some kind of a framework. But I think, you know, what needs to happen, there needs to be a consensus among the international community. We certainly would agree on that. But there needs to be some kind of deep thinking amongst all the international actors that are interested in Sudan. And that's not just the West, but it also includes the Qataris and the Saudis and some of the countries that are now basically bankrolling the regime. That regime change, or at least managed change, I should be precise, is necessary. And there needs to be some consensus about how you do that. The first thing, I think, the first step really would be up to Bashir, which would be to say, look, we know what's necessary. There have been other periods of, or there have been other times of crises in Sudan where we were able to establish a transitional council or a transitional government, where we asked other elements of the opposition to come in to some kind of a transitional framework to discuss the way forward. I mean, one of the reasons that this report is actually fairly historical to some degree is that in the 1980s, you had this kind of scenario. And in fact, you had a transitional council. They had very wide-ranging talks about what Sudan should look like or how it should be governed in a place called Kokodam in Ethiopia. There was wide agreement, at least on the principles of what was going to happen. They were actually going to initiate a roadmap. And guess what happened? The Islamists launched a coup to preempt that from happening. So, at least in our argument, in our view, these discussions have been had. I'm not saying that these discussions don't need to be had again, but that the broad parameters of what is required, most Sudanese elite know. The real question has always been, how do we get there? Now, again, I'm not saying that this is, you know, again, let's shove good money after bad. But I think that things could be put on a timeline that is linked to benchmarks in terms of a roadmap, which, to be perfectly frank, I don't want to provide. I think it's something that the Sudanese should negotiate. But you could put things on the table such as debt relief, highly indebted nation status with the World Bank and the other lending institutions. To be perfectly frank, one of the things that the Sudanese would love to see is the lifting of the terrorist designation that would allow them to access credit cards and things like that. I mean, there are a number of incentives that are on the table that are kind of, that are outlined a little bit in our report that I'm happy to talk about. But I think they're there that are not, that can be put out there, that it's not essentially just giving money after bad. I think the key to this is we do need to get Sudan's remaining allies on board. because the real problem is that the United States could push and push all at once, but it has very little leverage, particularly when there are other countries out there that are still willing to provide assistance, that are still willing to sell weapons, and so on and so forth.
Thanks. Omar, did you want to respond? Or should,
Just a little thing. With respect to the Arabs bankrolling the Khartoum, and also the suggestion of the deferral, I think the Arabs now understood, after all this rapprochement with Iran, if you will, and all the work that the destruction of the Yarmouk factory had opened up. Before that, it was a little known, hush-hush, discussed between the Arabs, but after it became open, I think the Arabs are now taking note of the ways that Bashir is dealing with Iran, knowing the fears of the Gulf states of Iran, and also their alliance with the United States, that is basically seeing Iran as being one of the dangers, perhaps in the words of another candidate, it was the danger. But now we know that is part of the dangers that the U.S. is facing. And this led the Saudis just last week, to stop paying $240 million that the Sudanese needed. And it was part of an agreement on paying back scheduled debts. And this is quite significant. The Saudis stopped paying for the longest time. The Qataris, yes, because Qatar had its own reasons why it is helping Sudan. We don't want to get into that, but in the discussion, if somebody wants to hear why. But most of the other Arab countries, the Kuwaitis, came in and they had the conference for the help of Eastern Sudan. They committed, they pledged, actually, about $10 billion. Not a penny of it came to Khartoum yet, because there were conditions. And also, one of these conditions is that Khartoum will stop dealing with the Iranians. And we see ships after ships today, as we speak, there were two Iranian ships visiting the port of Sudan. We don't know why they are visiting the port. And so regularly, and every time they are there for 2-3 days. I would love to see what they are doing. Are they just getting fuel and going back? Is this a friendly trip? We don't know. So these are all things that make the Arab states nervous. And they are not happy with the regime. And if you look at the Arab media, you will see that one columnist and opinion writer after the other, they were writing about this, and they are condemning the behavior of the government of Sudan. I think the incentive of deferring the thing according to Chapter 16, regardless of, you know, what that is going to do, or, a few years back when the discussion on it started, I think it is now people are way beyond that because of the weakness of Bashir himself. Yes, he is still controlling things in Khartoum, but there are many, many people inside the NCP who are challenging him today. And whether we believe the coup attempt or we don't, we know that there is discussion among people in Khartoum, and especially the youth of the NCP that are challenging this person. And there were people like Ghazi Salahuddin. He's not coming out and out, but the youth trust him more, and they are talking about him. The group of Nafi and those other guys on the one side, and Salah Ghosh and Ali Osman on the other side, maybe some of the people in the NCP today will tell you, don't do that to Bashir. Bashir is done with anyway, and we can take care of that. We don't know. But I don't think at this point in time that the deferral is going to do to make any difference. Maybe for Bashir himself to feel secure for 1 year. And I agree. There should be stringent conditions that, the transformation can happen. And one of these things might be an incentive like that. But I think on itself, as the major thing, it is not going to work. We are going past this. That is not going to save neither Bashir or the NCP today from itself. forget about the others who are waiting in line to take him out or to take the NCP out. Managed change begins and ends with supporting the opposition that is there to have a peaceful transition in Sudan, and I think that is where we should put our efforts.
Thanks, both of you. So let's open things up to questions and comments. I'll take two or three at a time, if that's all right with both of you. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Let's start here. Lauren.
Thank you. That was really excellent. A quick question for you on the idea of supporting the opposition forces, both armed and unarmed. Today, the head of the National Consensus Forces was arrested in Khartoum. Apparently, Sadiq al-Mahdi left the protest a little early. I'm wondering whether or not, or actually, what you see as sort of the major roadblocks to getting these various opposition groups together, the National Consensus Forces, the Sudan Revolutionary Front, Garifna, the various student protests. What's holding them back? Obviously, there are some differences between people with an Islamist agenda and not. But what's holding them back, and what more could be done quickly?
David Throop, CSIS, and Johns Hopkins. It strikes me that one of the problems of Washington of the last decade is that it has consistently failed to try to understand the position of the Khartoum government. And I think that is a major problem in any scenario setting strategy. And so the hard line taken by Omar Ismail and Enough over the last few years, I think, has exacerbated the problem and hindered the possibility of any kind of solution and transition inside Khartoum. Now we probably are at the end of the Bashir era. I think that's right. And I think we're probably heading for a train wreck, because it seems to me that the forces for change come as much from Islamist elements as from, if you like, the ancien regime. And Islamist elements not only inside the National Congress Party, but outside the National Congress Party. And in a sense, Bashir is caught absolutely in the middle and is incapable of making any concessions. It would have required a much more open-handed response by the United States and the international community after the comprehensive peace agreement to have changed the logic of Sudanese politics. And the crisis in Darfur and South Kordofan, of course, as far as Washington concerned, precluded that. So we have really driven them into the wall. And it seems to me very, very difficult to perceive where to go. I think EJ's strategy is a very attractive one, but I'm very dubious as to how far it's likely to work. But it is a sensible strategy. It is an option that might facilitate some unbreaking of the logjam. But that's my comment. Now my question. I'd like to hear both their opinions on the strength of the Islamist forces, both inside the ruling party and, if you like, to the Islamist left, right, however you care to categorize it, of Sudanese politics. How far the ancien regime, the old democratic unionists, the Ummah, I always ask this question and I never get a satisfactory reply, have in terms of their continued existence and viability and reality in a post-Bashir Sudan. And finally, the question is, my view is that the MCP, unlike all previous interventions in Sudanese politics, has fundamentally changed the rules of the game. That this is not simply a bunch of guys in Khartoum, that this is a revolutionary movement which, rather like Lenin, has changed the whole nature of Sudanese politics, right down to the grassroots. And I don't think I'd like to know your comments on that. I don't think we take sufficient cognizance of that.
Okay, so it's three questions for the price of one there, I think, at least. So any more? Well, let's start with all those, first of all. So who'd like to go first?
Well, the opposition forces, what's holding them back? This is going to sound ageist, but it's those really, really old guys who won't let go of power. I think it's Sadiq Ahmadi, it's Mirghani, it's those people who are damaged goods, I think, in the view of most Sudanese, who are unwilling to make or take strong positions because always in the back of their mind they're thinking that they could cut a deal with the regime that might benefit them. And I think, understandably, you know, the different leaders distrust each other, and I think that the youth and other activists are unhappy with that. And this is youth within the DUP and in the UMA and so on and so forth. I think one of the more interesting sociological problems really in Sudan is that you do have this deep divide between the youth, and if I correct me if I'm wrong, but the youth in Sudan includes people who are practically my age. I mean, 30 young 40 are still kind of shoved into the youth wing of the NCP and all these other areas. And so essentially the political system has been ossified to a large degree. And, you know, part of the problem really is that it's not just the opposition. The NCP is very, very good at divide and rule. It's been playing that game for 20 years. And it's great at creating all these splinter groups and so on and so forth. So I think it's a real challenge, which is why we raised it in our report. When it comes to the Islamist elements, I'm going to have to defer to Omar to a certain degree. What we are certainly hearing from our researcher is that you are seeing a growing kind of a Salafist tendency in Khartoum, and they can be very vocal, they can be very aggressive. They have, I hate to say it also, been used by the regime also. One of the scenarios that we certainly have discussed in the past is that I don't think that Bashir is that stuck. I mean, I think Bashir could pivot and put back the mantle of Islam and play that card if he really wants to. I think it would be a bad card to play, but I think it is one that he could that he could choose to pursue. When it comes to the other Islamist political parties, UMA and DUP, I think that obviously they still have a lot of support among rural populations, but
I don't mean them. I mean the guys more extreme.
Well, I mean, you know, I think, well...
The guys who went out in 99 and 2000.
Well, Tarabi. I mean, I think Tarabi...
Well, not only Tarabi, but the associated network.
Well, I mean, clearly, I mean, in our view, and certainly what we're hearing, is that there is a lot of debate within the Islamist movement as to which way the movement should go. But my understanding is that there are all kinds of different tendencies. I mean, I was talking to some people, and from what I understand, there were even people talking about the Turkey model or the Malaysia model for the government. So, I think Omar is in a better position to kind of speak very precisely about that. But our understanding is that is a discussion that's being had. It's just that the regime, for a number of reasons, is not allowing that discussion to be had in an open and forthright way, in large part because it is in crises. Now, you did make one interesting point, David, which was actually a point that has been made before by smarter people than me. But some people have argued that actually the NIF revolt was actually, you could think of it as the first Arab Spring. That this was actually a mass movement, not an inclusive movement, but it was a mass movement that toppled an old regime that imposed a new order. So to a certain degree, I do agree with you that it has changed the rules. And this is part of the problem between or with challenging the NCP. At least in my view, what is remarkable is that there really is only one political party in Sudan, and that is the NCP. The NCP is a very well-run and organized political party that provides patronage benefits to a huge range of people. It has representation throughout the country. It has networks that it uses to supply Ramadan gifts to its poorer supporters in the poor neighborhoods of Khartoum. And the other parties haven't caught up. I mean, the Ummah, DUP, the Communist Party, none of them have those kinds of networks. And to be perfectly frank, even the emerging opposition forces, particularly, which I find particularly frustrating, the SRF, none of them pay much attention to building constituencies within the country itself.
I will start from the last point you made, that the only political party in Sudan and the resources that it has. It's not the political party. It is the state that was turned into a political party. These are two different things. If you want to define a political party, this is not the definition of a political party. This is a political party that turned itself into the state and using the coffers of the state, the ability of the state, the network of the state to make itself this state within the party, not the party in the state. So that does not satisfy the definition of a traditional party that we are talking about. That is why there is no Ummah, there is no DUP, there is no Communist Party, because the state became the party. And everything that they own, because where the NCP got its resources from? Are they a political party that is being funded like the normal other political party? Did they give the other political parties the space that they have to move? So in so doing, and defining the political party as the NCP, and the other political parties do not exist, we are doing a disservice to ourselves in understanding what a political party is in the Sudanese context. And that is not a way to look at this. As for the revolution, anybody who got the tanks and the arms can do what the NCP did in 25 years. Let us not forget that. 25 years. But because the other Sudanese parties were playing the game as political parties before. Now, you are right that the political landscape is changed, and from now on, the Sudanese political parties without the NCP are going to do business differently. Yes, you are right. They are going to do business differently. And let us see when the political parties come and then there is democracy in Sudan, how they are going to behave and how they are going to set the rules and the limits between them and the state. That remains to be seen because it's an experience that they never had before. And that partly will answer the question of why the opposition is divided and weak, because the opposition traditionally were political parties that are competing. And now the NCP came in and they created a whole new way of doing business in politics. And the youth, as you said, yes, they are in a conflict between them and their leadership, because the leadership have been there forever. And they never had the chance to practice politics as we know it, so that they will be emerging leadership. And that is why Sadiq and Turabi and those guys were there for 50 years, because the political parties only exist in name. So that is what makes the opposition divided and very weak. But if we can help this opposition that is divided and that is very weak and fledgling, because it became a new opposition today, the youth of these parties are now pushing for reform within their parties and within the political system as a whole in Sudan. And this is not an easy task for people who were out of government, out of resources, and out of favor. But if we can work with them and create that political platform, the political platform is so essential, Lauren, you're right, because the mistrust between the opposition parties themselves and the people who are using the same slogan or the same justification of the NCP in Khartoum and saying, these are the disgruntled people who are coming from the periphery. Once they take over, they are going to change the landscape. And that is basically what the NCP is did, has done. The NCP, the first time, let us remember when Ali Al-Haj came and he was the minister of social works, under Turabi and Bashir and all these people, the first thing they did is re-engineering the Sudanese society. That was their mantra, re-engineering the Sudanese society. And they succeeded to a great degree in doing that. Did they take the Sudanism itself out of the Sudanese? That remains to be seen. We don't know that. Did they make Islam better, suited to rule the Sudanese society? We don't know. Did they hurt Islam in that process? Because there are lots of people that I know. They are saying, if that is the way that Islam is going to rule us, we will have to find a new way of thinking of our even belonging to Islam itself. And that is a debate that is going on in Sudan. Did that hurt Islam itself in essence? And make even political parties who were aspiring to become Islamist political parties, like the DUP and the Ummah party before, and looking for a constitution that is more Islamic leaning. If we go today among the parties and we ask, if you have the chance, going to vote for a constitution that is Islamic? I don't know what the answer will be, because the parties changed so much, and the ideologies of the parties are now become more questionable. And I will come to the last part, which is the first part, David. I don't think that I am, or the Enough Project, were that strong. You are giving us more credit than we deserve in terms of single-handedly or with others making Bashir headline. I think that is a power that I don't think we possess. But thank you for thinking of us that way. We wish that we can use this to advance, whatever that we are asking for. But, that aside, to be serious about it, I think, yes, we might be hawkish in terms of trying to deal with this government. That is because somebody like me, I understand where these people came from. 90% of the people that control this government today are the people that I met in my younger life as a student in the University of Khartoum, when the University of Khartoum was about 5,000 students. And if you are in a prelim, that is what we call the freshmen in Khartoum, you know everybody all the way to their sixth class in the School of Medicine. People like Atayb, Ibrahim, Muhammad Khair, and Ghazi Salahuddin, Mustafa Osman, Ismail, and all this, because they studied medicine, they stay longer. And the Islami, the Islamic Front at the time, they choose their leaders like Tijan Abdul Gadir and Muhammad Taha Mahna, and those guys, and they deliberately make them stay longer in the university so that they have good leadership, from one generation to the other. So within that time in the University of Khartoum, for 5 years that I spent there, I was a preliminary student, and I know people all the way to their sixth year. And then when I became on my fifth year, I remember all these guys. So the generation of about 12 people, 12 years, these are the people that we fought. And even others in different other universities like Yasser Arman and those guys in the University of Cairo branch. And we were all the same generation, people like Luca Biong in my class, Adil Elbaz, and all these 90% of the people who control the hinges of this government. We fought this from high schools through the University of Khartoum and after the University of Khartoum. That is why I understand them very well. I spoke with them. We fought with ideas and with crowbars also in the University of Khartoum. Some people like Atayb Sikha, who was brought from oblivion to become the chairman of this conference, the Islamic conference. They call him Atayb Sikha. Sikha is a crowbar. He was the one who supplied the Katiba of Mujahideen, the battalion of the Mujahideen. With them, Ali Mahmoud, who is now the Minister of Finance, he is my classmate. They sleep in the University of Khartoum mosque. And these are the guys that they call when they want them to come and intimidate other students while we're sleeping in the dorms. And they take students, herd them up to the roof of the dorms, and they use the bed sheets to tie us from our ankles and dangle us down like this. from the roofs. That is how we understand them. That is why we fought with these guys with ideas and other things. And they are the same people with the same mentality that are ruling Sudan today. That is why I am taking the position that I am taking. Because I understand nothing that we know in the accumulated history of civilization of human beings that gets in their skull. Nothing of that. They are a completely different breed of people that have one goal in mind, that we control this country. And like Trabi said, he is out of the scene, but his principles and ideas that brought these people to power, they are still running the country according to these principles and ideas. That this is not even our country. This is a platform that we use to launch the Islamic revolution in the rest of the world. That is the mentality of these people. And they are calling for martyrdom. And they say, if we stay here, we win this earth. And if we go and we died defending this, we win the hereafter. With that mentality, all these modern, you know, policies and things in history that we think can work with other people never worked in the two models, in Sudan and Iran, and it will never work.
Well, just for the USG people in the crowd, I mean, I certainly agree with Omer that helping build a more representative opposition would certainly be useful. I mean, if there is this, you know, if our idea is workable or is taken up, if you have a managed transition, obviously part of it would be that you would need to work with different political constituencies, and it would obviously be better if those constituencies were better organized and functioning. So I certainly don't want to take that off the table. I think to a large degree we agree on many of the things that need to be done. We just agree on a couple of few little ones.
Let's take another couple of questions. Jennifer, and then over here.
Yeah, thank you both, and it's great to hear the
So in terms of the near-term need for financing, especially in Khartoum, and how you guys see that driving decisions on oil restart and the security agreements that and concessions that come with such a restart, do you see that as something that's simply not possible based on your comments about how against the wall Bashir's regime is? Or is the financing need great enough, especially with the note that you mentioned on Saudi Arabia cutting off financing? Is the need great enough to move the ball on some of those security measures? Thanks.
Any others? Let's take the lady at the back there. All we have time for, so. Any other closing remarks you might have?
Oh, sorry. I very much think that we need to have a unified front, and so it becomes a question of what can they converge around. I to be perfectly frank, I think the consequences are already there. I think the regime is staring that in the face, that in fact it could crumble. And if you talk to Sudanese, they're all worried about basically the country. Either collapsing or essentially fragmenting into all these different states, right? You have Darfur coming back up as a separate country. You could have the New South, the Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile, seceding. There's all kinds of scenarios that they're talking about. So I think a lot of people do feel it's dire.
Well, I
hate to say it, but you know, I think the other alternative that does get discussed, usually in closed doors, is: are you going to have some kind of a frontline states initiative scenario again, right, where you have certain countries supporting the SRF, providing them with military assistance that would make them a real threat to Khartoum itself? To be honest, I think that's not tenable given the politics of the African Union right now. And I mentioned Libya because of that. You know, and the incentives, I think, again, are economic. I think that they need to be economic. I do agree with Omer that they need to be incentives that are provided as or are linked to specific benchmarks and things that they need to do before they get it, rather than, well, here's $20 billion and you just do these things for us, please. But I would argue that that's possible. And I think part of it is it's trying to get the Qataris and the Saudis along. I mean, I would differ a little bit with Omer about how tight this link is between Iran and Khartoum. But we are getting indications that the Qataris and the Saudis are going, we're spending good money after bad. If there's no change, you know, we're just going to keep dumping money into this country. I mean, you know, it's just to state the obvious, but some of you might know. I mean, the international community is spending over $1 billion a year on Sudan. $1 billion a year. That's a lot of money. So, I mean, I think there's money there that that people could use. When it comes to the financing, I'll move very quickly because I think we're running out of time. It's really complicated. I mean, the reality is that if they were rational states, they would come, they would have a deal. I mean, you know, we a year ago, and this shows you how right my analysis is, I would have told you that they would have somehow been able to keep the taps going because it was a win-win, right? They're all making money. And unfortunately, where we're now at is what I've called, what I've described as a game of chicken. I mean, this is typical Sudanese brinksmanship. It goes back decades, and essentially what they're doing is they're driving a car at each other, and one of them is hoping that the other one blinks. And the real problem is that, well, and I should say, blinks in that their economy collapses first. And I think the real fear is that both their economies are going to collapse.
Going to?
Well, collapse even more. But where it gets really complicated is you get a deal, and then the Chinese come and say, well, okay, the oil's going to come back up. We'll give you a loan. That kind of keeps everyone kind of puttering along for a while. Or the Qataris say, well, we'll buy up some of your sovereign debt. And that kind of kicks the can down the road. And that's essentially what they're all gaming. This is why you also get these wild statements from Khartoum and also from Juba that, oh, we just got X amount of money from so-and-so. Again, because they're playing this strategic game where they're hoping that the other side caves first. Quickly about the SRF. I mean, I think the SRF is an effective military alliance. That's it. They've been working very hard to try to build more of a political network. They've taken some small baby steps, but it's not a very unified organization at the moment. And part of it is because they still very much, in our view, are focusing on the military aspects of their campaign against Khartoum. And one of the things we've been, we've been surprised by is the fact that they're not being as political, at least internally, as we think that they should to be effective.
You get the final word.
I think this is one of the reasons that people like you, Jennifer, should always be in the room, honestly. And I appreciate what you've been doing and the voice of reason through the years in terms of
the
thinking. I believe, yes. Sometimes you want to amplify certain things and you keep others. And they were incentives. And the biggest incentive, I think, for the NCP to reach agreement on the CPA was that the NCP would remain. And that was the biggest incentive for them because they feared that the world might help, you know, the SPLM to take over, and they will be history. So I think, yes, there is got to be incentives there. But when we look at the package and try to bring in the incentives on the side of the consequences, we see which one will be more effective and how we can strike the balance within that package and to present it. And I think the beauty of the consequences is that they work with or without incentives. Because with the incentive case is that you will say, these are the benchmarks, these are the things that you will do by this time, and if you don't, this is what you're going to get. So I believe that is why I cannot take it out of any a package that I'm going to deliver to Khartoum. And to be fair to the ICG report, I've read it, and they put very, very difficult consequences to the extent that somebody will say, Khartoum will never agree to this. Then why bother even? But they put a lot of, you know, things that are good there. However, when you come to, it is how you deliver it. It is how you make them believe that that's, and also the credibility of the international community had always been in question. And it should be, you know, that the international community not only unified behind the consequences, but they're also unified behind the incentives, and to be given in a way that Khartoum will believe it, even though they will always run behind and look for dividing the international community, and like I said, the international community never failed to oblige. The SRF, I think. People were very quick to condemn the SRF in the beginning because they see a ragtag group that is, what brings the people from the Nuba Mountains and Darfur and the East and the remnants of the SPLM and, the South was left to go, why they are meddling in the business of the North. They were part of the North until yesterday, and the North were meddling in their business for 50 years. Can you take 5 years, maybe, of meddling in the business of the South into the North? I think the SRF needs to articulate a political platform. There is no alternative to that. Yes, they will work hard to try to become a formidable force to reckon with. But it's still a lot of people, and this is an internal debate in Sudan, people were saying, look at Darfur. Because those guys were fighting in Darfur, Darfur is now destroyed, and Khartoum is happy. As long as it is not in Khartoum, no. That is what led Khalil, the late leader of JEM, to go all the way from N'Djamena to Khartoum. And he says, I am going to take this battle to Khartoum and make them taste it and to see that, there is something that is happening. Maybe SRF was, thinking of this as well. Maybe they were thinking today that the biggest hub that is hurting them in South Kordofan and in Darfur is Kadugli or Orobait. And if they take Kadugli or they take Al Obeid, they will deprive the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, from this middle basis where they can concentrate their efforts. But that is still not a solution. I think what the SRF needs to do to articulate a platform that will include, reaching out to the opposition inside Khartoum as well. And to bring the Grifna and the student unions that are now reaching out to other student unions around the area, and we see that they were in the last week there were demonstrations in Adbara and in Dongola and in Madani and in Khartoum. It was not just in Khartoum, like it started in Niala and elsewhere. The next thing, and this is how the Sudanese revolution, if you will, progresses, and we have seen that in April of 1985, and way back in October of 1964, without going deep into history, but we will say the next step is going to be the trade unions. Yes, they were destroyed and they were old, and the NCP created their alternative trade unions, but it's still the elements of political trade unions and the democratic so-called trade unions are there. That is the next thing, because when the trade union of the doctors say, we are going to strike, and the engineers say, we are going to shut down the water and electricity, and the teachers are going to stay home and they are not going to the school, and so on, then we will have civil disobedience all over the country, and that is going to paralyze the country more than it is paralyzed today. That is the next step that is going to happen in Khartoum in terms of ratcheting up the opposition to this government. So I believe, and I will conclude with this by saying, 30 million Sudanese deserve a government better than the NCP that has been there for almost quarter a century today. And we don't see an end on sight, except the work of the many people in Sudan that sacrificed and work hard and is still working for a better life, and for people around the world to think of some people being freedom fighters and others condemned as terrorists and this and that. Tell that to the people who are there and fighting every day and trying to make a living through this. And also tell it to the mothers of these four students last week that they were sleeping in their dorms, that they were snatched out of University of Jazeera and taken to the security, tortured and killed, and they dumped them in the sewage system. And I think the Sudanese have tried their level best in different ways, shapes, and forms to contest this regime like it has never been in the history of Sudan. The fighting in the east, the fighting in Darfur, the fighting in the Nuba Mountains, the fighting in the Blue Nile, and the fighting in the south before. Yes, the south is a different case because it has been from August of 1955. We cannot blame this government solely for that. There are so many people to blame. But the fact that all these other parts of Sudan picked up arms and they were fighting this regime, that tells us that the majority of the Sudanese people are not behind this regime, or else they wouldn't have to come to power through a military coup and stay with the power of the bayonet of their guns. I think the Sudanese people are capable of producing some sort of Mandela if there is a chance. The challenge will be for the NCP to try to provide one de Klerk. I don't think they are capable of doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, both of you. Thanks so much for both of our speakers for all those insights and great debate. So much tough policy discussion, but thanks to all of you coming, and more on Sudan in the new year.